Anyways, so after the story of the Korach rebellion, what I want to analyze is the next story, which is really sort of weird, because you know you would have thought after the earth opens up, swallows the political dissidents, and fire comes down from heaven and kills the religious rebels, like that would be it, and the rebellion would be quashed, and we would move on. But instead, what you get is this in the first story. So you get Perek Yud Zayin, where that's not what happens at all. Instead, Vaydaber Adonai Moshe Lemor, Emor El Ezeb Ben Aaron HaKohen Vayarem Et HaMachdot Mibein HaSreifa V'Eish Zerehala Ki Kadeshu. So first, Hashem tells Moshe to tell Elazar to take the fire pans that were used for the Ketoret, and use them to build a cover for Mizbeach. And Machtor Achatayim Ha'ilu B'Nafshatam V'Asu Otam Rikuei Fachim Tzipui L'Mizbeach Hi Krivam L'Fnei Adonai V'Yikdashu V'Yuhu L'Ot L'Fnei Yisrael. Take these fire pans, melt them down, make them into a cover for the Mizbeach, because these people sacrificed to God and became holy, and it'll be a sign for the Jewish people. So he does that. He takes this copper and he covers the mizbeach. And he does this so that there will be a commemoration for the Jewish people not to bring a false Ketoret, not to be like Korach and his group, like God said to Moshe. What?
Hi, Rabbi.
How you doing? Welcome. And, you know, you would think that this would work. You know, if you had to guess, you would say this would work, right? You know, you take the physical symbol of the death of these people, the miraculous fire coming down, to remind them not to rebel. You would have thought it would work either permanently or maybe even, you know, at least for a little bit, a day or two, right? People wouldn't rebel. And instead, what you get is that this becomes the beginning of a new rebellion. Vayilonu kol adat b'nei Yisrael mimacharat al Moshe ve'aron lemor atem hamitem et am Adonai. Instead, the very next day, the people turn to Aaron and Moshe and say, "You killed the nation of God," right? Which is this bizarre. You would think like it would have at least quashed rebellion for a little bit, but it doesn't, not at all. But their argument is even worse than that. It's not just that it's rebellion. It's, you know, this rebellion seems very odd because it's a recognition. Right? Before, Korach was denying that Moshe represented God. He was a charlatan, right? He's making this all up. Really, we're all holy. You're trying to take all the power for yourself. The Jews recognize that Moshe apparently has the power to kill people magically, right, miraculously. So they're not denying his power, and yet it seems specifically their recognition of his power what leads them to rebel, right, which just compounds the bizarreness of this story. Vayhi bihi kahel aidal Moshe v'Aaron vayfnu el ol moed v'inechi so anan vayirach vod Adonai. So they gather against Moshe and Aaron, and they turn to the ol moed, to the tent, and God's spirit in the cloud has descended on it, and God appears. Vayavo Moshe Aaron el pnei ol moed. So Moshe and Aaron go in, and God gives them the message. Vayidaber Adonai Moshe lemor heyrom mitoch haida azot v'achala otam karaga vayiplu al pneihem. He says, "Remove yourself from these people, and I will destroy them in a moment." And they fall on their face in prayer. There is sort of this fascinating linguistic irony that God says Hiroma, which literally means lift yourself up out, and in protest of this decree, they fall down, right? There's this imagery of you pick yourselves up and I'll destroy them. So Moshe and Aaron don't just not pick themselves up. They don't want God to do it, so they do the opposite, right? They throw themselves vertically down, which is the directional opposite of what God wanted them to do, to destroy the Jewish people. Vayomer Moshe Aaron kachan amachta v'tenala eish me'al mizbeach v'sim ktoret And Moshe then intervenes, and he tells Aaron, take the same fire pan, put ktoret on it, and run into the middle of the Jews and atone for them, because the plague has come out from God. So Aaron takes it, and he runs into the people, and indeed this plague had started, and he puts the ktoret, and he atones for them. And he stands between the living and the dead, and he stops the plague. And another 14,700 people were killed in this plague, in addition to the people who had been killed in the Korach incident. Aaron returns to Moshe. And then we get a second test in Tet Zion through Chav Zion, but we'll come back to that in a minute. Now this whole thing, as I said, is very, very odd. You know, the rebellion just finished, and then, on the one hand, it doesn't manage to quell rebellion at all. The next day they're rebelling, but it's a weird rebellion, because it doesn't seem to be. It's a rebellion despite what just happened. It seems to be a rebellion because of what just happened. Right? It's not a denial of Moshe's power, it's a recognition. You are powerful, and that's why we're angry, because you killed the Jewish people, right? It's the inverse of the rebellion of Korach, right? It's not a denial that you represent God, it's a recognition that, yeah, you have all this power, and you're using it to kill the Jewish people. And this apparently makes God even angrier than Korach, because in Korach, the 250 assorted people die, and here there's this massive plague of 14,700 people, bringing you to about a round number of about 15,000 people in this incident. And you just got to wonder what is going on in this moment.
How many people were there at that time?
So men, there are 603,550, right, in the last census. So, you know, 15,000 people, we're talking, it's a percentage, you know. Mm-hmm. It's a few percent of the whole, right? It's, you know, about 2.5% of the entire nation dies in this incident. Right, so it's a lot, right? It's 1 in 40 people die just in this incident. So what I think is going on here, and this is really a key to a lot of what goes on in the Torah, and this is a theory that I've heard developed by different people, the most, I think, sort of succinctly by a very good friend of mine, Rabbi David Block, had a brief share on this on Aleph Beta, along with Immanuel Shalev, another friend of mine. And this is, the theory goes as follows. The Jews have a very weird relationship with Moshe throughout the Torah. They sort of jump back and forth consistently between viewing him as a human being and as a demigod. Right? God, a demigod. Right? They can never quite... There's not like a rational approach to it. It's just they sort of go back and forth in their relationship with Moshe. And this creates a lot of problems. They never quite wrap their heads around where Moshe stands on the human being, God, demigod trajectory. And this creates a lot of stress in their life. And the evidence really is number two, is these few very odd psukim right at the beginning, or in the introduction, really, of the Chet HaEgel, right before what the psukim that describe the Jews' lead up to worshiping the golden calf. So, right, I just put four psukim here, but if you follow how they describe Moshe, it's very, very weird. So, Vayara Am Kivoshesh Moshe Laredet Minahar, Vayika Hel Ha'am Alaharon Vayomru Elav, Kum Aseilanu Elohim. Asher yalchu lefaneinu. Right, so the Jews see that Moshe doesn't come down. So they go and they say to Aaron, make for us a god who will lead us. Kizeh Moshe Ha'ish, because Moshe, the person, Asher Elanu Meretz Mitzrayim Lo Yadanu Mehayalo, who took us out of Egypt, we don't know what happened to him. And this pasuk is self-contradictory at multiple levels. Right? Moshe is a person, but if Moshe is absent, then we need a God. Because Moshe may be a person, but he took us out of Egypt. But he didn't take us out of Egypt. God with a capital G took us out of Egypt. Right? So there's a three-way confusion. God is the one who took us out of Egypt. But Moshe is described as simultaneously being the person who took them out of Egypt, which makes him almost equivalent to God with a capital G. He's described as an ish, right, as a human being, but the only replacement for Moshe isn't another ish, isn't Elohim, is a God with a small g. So it's clear that their approach to Moshe is very confused, and that's the problem. They recognize
the distance there too.
Yeah,
I mean, that man.
Or that, yeah, I mean, he's this Moshe, mm-hmm. Right? It's, we recognize he's not quite God, but he's also not quite human. Mm-hmm. Meaning he's human, so if he disappeared, he might be dead. But we can't replace him with another human being because he's not quite human either, because he took us out of Egypt like God. So the only way to replace him is with a small g God. Right? And this is what creates the panic, is that Moshe is, for them, he's not quite God, so he is human, he could die, but they don't know how to live without him, because he's not quite man either. They haven't wrapped their heads, he's somewhere in between.
Maybe they know he's a man, but like he's in between the nation and God.
Well,
in terms of like he's there, like every time they need someone to pray to ask what's happening, they need to pray to Moshe, to pray to God, So that's why, like, when Moshe didn't come back, they didn't have the connection to the God.
Yeah, and that's, you know, and that's part of the question of whether the Egal Zav is actually an idol. It may just be an intermediary. But you're right, that's exactly the problem, is he's a demigod / he's their conduit to God. He's their intermediary to God, right? That's his point, is he holds this weird state, right? He is not just a man. He's a man, but he's their only way of communicating with God. He is a man, but he performs miracles God-like. Right, exactly, that's the point, is he's somewhere in between, because he performs miracles on behalf of God. He communicates with God for the people. So without him, right, you're severed from God with a big G, right? And if you don't have Moshe, you need a God with a little g, right? That's sort of the chaos that's created, is that Moshe, and it's not rational, right? The sentence doesn't make sense. Nothing in the sentence makes sense. It makes sense from the vantage point of panic, right, that Moshe occupies this state between us and God, whatever it is. We don't know, he's a man, he's a demigod, he's our you know, intermediary to God, he's the one who communicates with God, he davens on our behalf, he tells us what God is thinking, but without him, we're lost. Vayomer Aleihem Aharon, so Aaron then says to them, that's funny that got changed. Okay, I just put in automatic change for God, but, you know, Aleihem is not God, it's just to them. But okay. Vayomer Aleihem Aharon, Parku Nizmei HaZahav Asher Basnei Nesheichem B'neichem V'notechem V'aviu Eli, so take off the gold and silver, the gold, yours and your wives and your children, bring it to me. Vid Parku Kol Amit Nizmei HaZahav Asher Basneihem V'aviu El Aharon, so they take all the gold, they bring it to Aharon. V'yikach Mi'adam V'yatzer Ato Bacheret, so they take the gold and they make this molten image, and then the sentence is again jumbled. Vayomru, and they say about the calf, Eila Elohecha Yisrael, this is your God, Asher Halucha Meretz Mitzrayim. Right. So now, replacing, so two psukim before, you had Moshe Ha'ish, you had a human being called Moshe who is described as taking that out of Egypt, which is the role of God with a capital G. And now they replace Moshe with an Elohim, lowercase g, who took him out of Egypt. Right? And this is like, right, it doesn't make sense. There's a bit of a, right, there's not rational, right? There's three levels going on here of God, the God, of God's lowercase g, and Moshe as a human being. But without Moshe and without that intermediary to God, they just panic and they create a God lowercase g. But what you see just in those four psukim is that the Jews, part of the Jews' problem in their relationship with Moshe is that on the one hand, they rely on him too much because he's almost godlike, or he is their only way of communicating with God. But on the other hand, he's a human being, and therefore he is can be challenged. And it's not like rational. Sometimes they challenge him, sometimes they don't. Sometimes it's specifically his humanity they challenge, and sometimes it's specifically his divinity that makes them angry. If we come back to our story, that seems to be what is going on, is that the Korach incident was all the way at one extreme. Was Korach turns to Moshe and says, "You're not God, nor do you represent God. You're just a power-hungry person. And you're using God, you're using this God as a way of getting power." Now that is decisively proven as wrong. Right? It's not true. They are, the people who challenge him are swallowed up by the earth and swallowed up by the fire. It's clear, he's not a charlatan. But now the Jews can do one of two things. Moshe is not a charlatan. Right? He's not faking it. But now they have two ways of responding. One is to say, he is a messenger of God, but God is calling the shots, and therefore we can't challenge him, because challenging him is just challenging God with a big G. Or they can say, no, we were wrong that Moshe is a mere human being, but maybe he still doesn't represent God. Maybe Moshe is a demigod. He's this superhuman. And therefore, maybe the reason he performed the miracles wasn't because God told him to. It's because he has independent standing on the divine spectrum. And therefore, he used his own powers to hurt the Jewish people. And that's where they go. Instead of coming to the conclusion, God is behind it. And therefore, Moshe is not to blame for the death of the people. They swing towards the other channel of rebellion. It's not you're a mere human, it's you're a superhuman, and it was you, not God, who killed the people. Right? So, and it's this weird space that Moshe occupies, that sometimes they challenge him because you're a mere human being, and sometimes they challenge him because they say you are so powerful that you act independently. And therefore, when bad things happen, it's not God's fault, it's your fault. And Moshe has to somehow always bring them back to the middle. No, I'm not a mere human being, I actually represent God. But no, I'm not calling the shots either. Right? I am powerful because I represent God. And therefore you can't challenge me, but you also can't accuse me of being the one responsible for punishing you. I'm in neither spot. Right? I'm not God, and I'm not a mere human being. I'm God's representative to you. And therefore, don't take it up with me. It's God. But that's very hard, because the Jews always panic. Right? Because now, the scariest thing that they can possibly actually believe is what I just said, is that Moshe is not a God, and he accurately portrays God's will. Because then, when God punishes Korach, they're forced to believe this isn't a vindictive human being with a lot of power punishing us. It is legitimately the will of God, and there is no recourse, that we actually deserve this. Right? If God, capital G, is calling the shots and not Moshe as a superhuman, then we're really guilty and this is really bad. And they don't want to believe that. Anything they can do to not believe that, they will do. It doesn't matter. It could be in last week's parsha, or last week's shir, denying that Moshe has any standing with God. In this week's parsha, it's believing that Moshe has independent standing and is calling the shots. Whatever they can do to deny that it's God with a capital G that is deciding to punish them, right? Whatever they can do, and they will believe, because they always have this weird relationship with Moshe. Right? And whichever side of the equation they need to believe at that moment, they will. And that, right, and there God goes crazy. But it's calculated. Because what does the solution last week was that Hashem had to allow Moshe to put his foot down and have them all be swallowed up by the earth. But now, another miracle won't prove anything. Because now they're not denying that Moshe is powerful. Now what they need to do is they need to know that God is behind it, and Moshe isn't vindictive. Moshe's on their side. This is not him. This is God. The miracle has to be very carefully calculated to support Moshe without over-supporting him. And that's, you know, and this is sort of a weird place in Bamidbar, right? Because until now, we've watched Moshe's leadership deteriorate. The people lose trust in him. Right now we go to the other extreme. Now they have too much faith in Moshe himself, so they're challenging him for using his intense power. And here's where we come back to our story. So Hashem calculates this very carefully. And Hashem says, I'm going to destroy them. I'm going to punish them. And you're going to save them. But that seems to be how the scene is calculated. That's the only way that you can recalibrate in the middle. Right, God says, if it's up to me, I will destroy them. Right, leave them alone and leave it to me. And Moshe and Aaron saying, no, we're going to switch sides. We will stand up for the Jewish people against you. Right, we will. You want us to pull ourselves up, we'll throw ourselves down. And then what's fascinating is that Moshe, the Pasuk never says that God told him, stop the Magefa. It just says that God said there is a magefa, and Moshe turns to Aaron and says, go stop it. I have a secret. Go, bring the Ketoret, and you'll save the Jewish people. And if you look at, and just skip all the way to the end, to 4, right? Rashi tells a story from a midrash as follows. Vayamod bein hametim. Aaron stood between the dead and the living. Achaz ed hamalach ve'hemidu al karcho. Aaron grabs the angel of death and stops him against his will. Amar lo, hamalach, hanech li la'asot shlichuti. Leave me alone and let me be so I can carry out my mission. Amar lo, and he said to him, Moshe tzivani la'akev al yadcha. So the angel says to him, Aaron says to the angel of death, but Moshe told me to stop you. Amar lo, ani shlucho shel makom. But I'm a messenger of God. Vata shlucho shel Moshe. And you're a mere messenger of Moshe. Amar lo, ein Moshe omer klum milibo el mipi agvura. Moshe never says anything without God. Im ein atam amin, hare HaKadosh Baruch Hu Moshe el petoch ol moed. You don't believe me? Moshe and Hashem are talking at the door of the Ohel Moed. Boi mi v'shael. So come, let's consult. We'll ask. V'zeu shne'amar v'yeshev Aaron al Moshe. That's what it means that Aaron took him back, right? Took the angel back to Moshe. Davar acher. Alternatively, lama b'ktore. Well, you know, let's stop there for a moment. Right? This story that the Midrash tells captures that moment very well. Right, it's the ambiguity in the story is that God says I'm going to destroy the Jewish people. Moshe says I'm going to stop it, and it's not clear whether he's sent by God or not. But if he's sent by God, that means God is working against himself. If he's not sent by God, then how does he manage to successfully fend off God's decree? Right, that's the weirdest thing in the story. So the Midrash tells a story that Moshe sends Aaron to stop the angel of death. And the angel of death is totally confused. And he says, I don't get it. God sent me and you're stopping me. And Aaron says, no, Moshe represents God. But God did send him. Right? So which is it? But I think what the Midrash is getting at is, yeah, that's exactly what had to happen in the story. Is that God had to punish the Jewish people, and Moshe had to, with some level of independence, act with Aaron to save the Jewish people, seemingly against God's wishes. That's what you needed, right? Was you needed it to be clear that Moshe clearly couldn't stop God if God didn't want him to stop him. But he also wanted Moshe to choose to stop him and give him the right to do that. That's what you needed. You needed this very bizarre moment where Hashem is going to start punishing the Jews, but give the tools to Moshe to stop it if he wants. So it clearly has God's stamp of approval, but it needed to come from Moshe's initiative. And that seems to be Hashem's way of balancing this bizarre power structure, of saying Moshe's not just a human being, because look, he can stop the angel of death. But he's not vindictively using his own power, because look, he'll stand up for you, for the Jews, against me, and I'll let him do it. Because that's the space I want him to occupy. I want him to simultaneously represent me to you and represent you to me. I want him in that weird space. And I want you to recognize that's his space. Right? He does represent me, but he's not vindictively against you. He represents my message to you, but sometimes he challenges me to protect you. Right? That's his goal. Right? That's what he does. And we saw this in the Egel as well. Right? He says to God, right? Now God clearly wants him to. Right? God gives him the opening. But he wants Moshe of his own initiative to challenge God and save the Jewish people in the Egel. And then, you know, a few psukim later, the Moshe who saved all the Jewish people goes down and says, Mila Hashem Eli, and kills the sinners. Because he's in the middle. The people who deserve to die, he will carry it out for God. And the people who don't really deserve to die, he will defend them from God. He will always be playing both sides. That's how he manages to be the truest representative of God and the people at the same time. It's an impossible space. But that's what Hashem wants him to do. And the second thing that Rashi tells you is that it's not just God they have this, it's not just Moshe they have this weird relationship with, it's the Ketoret as well. Right? God calibrates it perfectly, because it's not only that he saves them through Moshe, who's this in this weird space right now. But Rashi continues, Davar acher, lama biktoret, lefi shayu Yisrael melizinum. Yeah, exactly. Because everyone now is saying, melizinum ranin achar haktoret, lomar samam avidu. They're all making fun of the Torah and saying it's the, right, it's poison. It's deadly poison. Because al yadom meitu nadav avihu, al yadom nisruv chamim mishumatayim ish, nadav and avihu died when they brought the Ketoret unannounced, and the 250 men died. Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, tiru shotzer magefahu. So God says, let the same thing that killed the people then save them, so they'll know it's not the Ketoret which kills or doesn't kill, it's sin. Right? That's what I need them to... Right? So what Rashi is telling you is the miracle is perfectly calibrated to put Moshe where he needs to be, right? In the not God, because God is responsible for the punishment, and put them on the Jews' side, but not fully on the Jews' side, because right, he, you know, just before was attacking those who deserved to die. Right? He was the one who initiated that. He represents the Jews and he represents God and the Ketoret as well. He doesn't want people to get into this mythical thinking that it's the Ketoret that kills. No, it's not the Ketoret. It's sin that kills. It's doing the right thing that makes you survive and doing the wrong thing that makes you not survive. Moshe just represents this. Right? It's not the Ketoret. It's not Moshe. It's God calling these shots. And that's what this story has to do, right? That's what the story is doing. It's this weird, right? It's pushing the other direction, right? Now they're rebelling against Moshe, not because they think he's a man, but because he's too powerful and he's using it vindictively. So God is saying, no, he's not quite a God, nor is he vindictive. And I'll prove it to you. I'll punish you and he'll save you. So he's not quite human because he knows how to stop the angel of death. But he's not vindictive either, because he's stopping the angel of death, not sending him. Right? That's the point. He's in the middle. Don't rebel against him in either direction. Right? Don't rebel because he's a mere human, and don't rebel because you think he's calling the shots as a superpower. He's not. And that's a very hard lesson to teach, and that's what Hashem's trying to do. And then he continues. God makes one last miracle. And he says, in the Pasuk Tet Zayin, picks up the second half of the story. Vaydaber Adonai el Moshe l'amor. Daber el b'nei Yisrael v'kach meitam mateh mateh lefeit av me'eit kol nesiyem lefeit avotam shneim asar matot ish et shmo tichtov al mateyu. I have one last thing I want you to do. Gather a stick, a staff, from every head of house of each of the nesiyem. I mean, one per shevet, one per tribe. And each leader should write their name on the stick. And on the one that represents the tribe of Levi, put Aaron's name. And then put them in the Olmoed where I meet with the Jewish people. And the person whose stick will bloom, thank you. That will remove all of the critiques that they have on you. So Vaydaber Moshe al Bnei Yisrael, Vaytnu alehem kol nisiyehem, Matei l'nasi echad, Matei l'nasi echad, Levei avotam, Shnei masar matot, Matei Aaron betoch matotam. So they do this, they take the 12 staffs, including Aaron's, Vayanach Moshe et matot lefnei Adonai b'ol ha'idud, and then he takes the staffs and he puts them in the ol ha'idud. Vahi mimacharat, Vayvo Moshe ol ha'idud, Vihinei parach, Matei Aaron levei levi, Vayotza ferach, Vayatzes tzitz, Vaygmol shkeidim. So they go to the next day, and behold, it has bloomed, and flowers have grown out of it, and almonds specifically have grown out of it. So he takes them all outside. And then Hashem says to Moshe, take the stick into and put it next to the Aron to as a reminder to the rebels, and they will stop complaining and they won't die. Vayas Moshe kasher tziva Adonai oto kenasa, and Moshe does as Hashem tells him. Now this miracle sounds very nice, right? It's much less, right? No fire and brimstone, and yet here the Jews' reaction is hopelessness. Vayomru bnei Yisrael Moshe lemor, hein gavadnu avadnu kulanu avadnu. Behold, we have perished, we are lost, we are all lost. Kol ha-karev ha-karev el mishkan adonai yamut, ha-im tamnu lingvoa. All who come to the mishkan shall perish, have we stopped perishing? Right? It's like, finally you get like a nice, wholesome miracle, and the Jews' reaction is, they are petrified, out of their minds, right? They give up. And amazingly, these are the last words that you hear of the Jewish people of this generation. This is it. The next time we hear their speech in the Torah, it's 38 years later. This is the last words you hear from this generation is, have we stopped dying? And the answer is, no, we have not stopped dying. This is the end of these people. You will never hear from them again. They all die right now in the Torah. You don't hear about their death. There's just silence. Right, the next thing in the Torah is nothingness. Is the law of the red of the paraduma? Is the laws of how you purify yourself from the dead? The reason I assume it's there is because we don't find out. All we know is that there was 8 years of death. That's literally the next thing, right? Is silence and death, and then you wake up in Chukat and you're talking to the next people. What is going on here, and why are they panicking, and why this miracle, and why this? So, yeah.
It's okay. I'll ask you later.
It's important to note, first of all, that these two units are parallel to the Korach unit, meaning, as we've already highlighted, at some level, this unit and the Korach unit are two sides of the same coin, right? Before you have, you know, both times you have Vayikalu al Moshe v'Aaron, you have them congregating against Moshe, against Aaron, and you have this, you know, this complaint against them of how they treat the Jewish people, right? And one is, why are you lording yourself? And one is, why are you killing them? In both cases, Moshe falls on his face. Now, admittedly, it's very different. In Korach, he's falling on his face in despair, giving up on the Jewish people. In this story, he's falling on his face to defend the Jewish people, but the stories are clearly just two sides of the same coin. And they're trying to get, you know, and both of them have this notion, right, of God saying, look, separate and I'll kill them all. And Moshe saying, no, don't kill them all, right? It's the same story, just again. But also both stories are about convincing the Jewish people that Aaron is the legitimate Kohen, right? Part of it is about Moshe and part of it is about Aaron. The first story didn't prove anything, apparently, about Aaron, because you know, after that whole miracle, and the 250 people think they're at, they're still not sure. So God has to do a total second round of miracles, this whole blossoming of the staff. And the question is why? And the answer seems to be what we said before, is that part of the problem was that the message of the first tests only work if the people believe that God is behind it, and not Moshe using his semi-divine powers. Right? That's the only way this acts as a proof. If you give too little credit to Moshe, then Moshe and Aaron are delegitimized. If you give too much power to Moshe and Aaron, you know, in terms of, not in terms of their truth, but simply in their power, it doesn't prove anything, because then it's not them who put, it's not God who put them to death for their crime against Aaron. It's Moshe and Aaron with their supernatural powers. That, okay, Moshe and Aaron are powerful. That doesn't prove they're right. Right? Power, right? Might doesn't make right necessarily. So they're mighty. I get it. So Professor Yoni Grossman sort of takes this together and says, yeah, that's what's going on here. He says, now we're able to answer the third question. Why was it only after the second test, the blossoming of Aaron's staff involving no death, that the people fear to approach the Mishkan? As mentioned, this fear would have seemed more appropriate following the first test, when more than 250 people lost their lives. But in light of our discussion, it's only in the wake of the second test that it becomes clear to the nation that the 250 indeed lost their lives because they offered incense without being permitted to do so. Right? It's the softness of the miracle. Right? If Moshe was trying to take revenge, was trying to quash them into believing that him and Aaron were real, you don't do a nice, gentle miracle of, oh, look, my staff bloomed and yours didn't. Right? That's a miracle that, because of its softness, it's clear that that's a miracle that's meant to communicate a message, not quash you into submission. The first miracle scared them because they said, oh, Moshe and Aaron are super powerful. But it didn't scare them because, in the sense that it didn't convince them that Moshe and Aaron were right, that they were actually evil, that they actually did something wrong. But when you have the second miracle where God says, look, I don't need to quash anybody into submission. Moshe and Aaron are on your side. They're defending you. And the miracle this time is going to be gentle. Right? I'm not going to scare anybody. I'm just going to make it bloom. Suddenly the Jews panic because they realize, oh, this isn't a power play by Moshe and Aaron. Moshe and Aaron stand up for us. And the reason Aaron is the Kohen Gadol is because he deserves to be the Kohen Gadol. And the reason these miracles are happening is not because Moshe and Aaron are vindictive, but because God told them to do it. Now that make us less scared of Moshe and Aaron, but it makes us more scared because it means everything they've said is true. And we're actually guilty. Right? This isn't vindictiveness. This is God making a decision through them. That's in its peace and quiet and silence is much more terrifying than the notion that maybe we have super powerful vindictive leaders. Right? Having calm leaders who try to defend us from God and communicate his message, but if that message is negative, there's no way out. Right? Moshe and Aaron defend us as much as they can. Right? And he says, it's only after Aaron's selection was clearly and openly displayed that they'd understood the second claim had simply had no substance, and that the Kodesh itself consumed those who entered without authorization. Now the nation experiences the full awe and fear of approaching the Kodesh, which brings death to those who are not permitted to be there. So Yoni Grossman says this locally, right? That they're afraid of the Mikdash. It's only when they realize how powerful the Mikdash is, the Mishkan is, and that you get killed if you walk in when you shouldn't, they only have proper awe of the Mishkan when they realize that it's not Moshe and Aaron being vindictive. It's God. Because then suddenly, the 14,700 people who died, it's not Moshe's vindictiveness, it's God. And next time we do something wrong, next time we go into the Mishkan when we shouldn't, it'll be God again. And maybe Moshe and Aaron won't defend us, or maybe they won't successfully defend us. Right? Once you balance it and you calibrate it, and the Jews no longer think that Moshe and Aaron are charlatans, nor do they think they're calling the shots, that means every shot they did call is just God speaking through them, which is sometimes comforting. It's not comforting if the message is itself scary. And therefore they panic, Because it's specifically in the quiet of that miracle that they really get it. Oh, Moshe and Aaron aren't vindictive superpowers. They're just God's representatives. But God said we're going to die if we violate his law. We go into the Mikdash when we're not supposed to. Now, back to sort of my friends, you know, David Block and Imu Shalev, they know this isn't just true at the microcosm. It's true at the macro level, too. And as I said, these aren't just the last words the Jews speak in this incident. They are, maybe not coincidentally, the last Jews of this, the last words these Jews ever speak. And they suggest that it's not just their recognition that the Mishkan is scary, that the Mishkan is dangerous, that makes them panic. It's also that they've been grappling with the question of what does it really mean when Moshe tells us that God said we're all going to die in the desert? Now, as long as they rebel against Moshe and they say either you're a human being and therefore you don't represent God, or they say you're a superpower and therefore you're just vindictive, both extremes would let them justify themselves, maybe we're not really going to die in this desert. Right? Either Moshe's lying or Moshe's vindictive. But you know what? A vindictive super demigod figure, maybe we'll be able to convince him elsewhere, right? Maybe he'll calm down. But the second you calibrate and say, no, God is just the honest representative of God. He does everything in his power to defend you. And despite the fact that Moshe does everything that he can to defend you, he couldn't defend you from that decree. That's when they totally panic, because they realize, oh, if even Moshe can't defend us, then when he said we're going to die in this desert, we're going to die in this desert. And they said that sentence isn't just about the Mishkan. That sentence is literally the summary of the next 38 years. Is Heng avanu avanu kulanu avanu. We are dying. We're lost. We're all lost. Which is true. Ha'im tamnu l'gvo. Have we stopped dying? Now the answer may be, in the context of the Mishkan, yeah, you've stopped dying. Don't go in the Mishkan, you won't die immediately. But the answer on the macro level is no, you haven't stopped dying. This is it. This is the beginning of the end. You're not going in. You're done. And these are the last words they speak. And, you know, so if you're tracing through Bamidbar this weird relationship with Moshe, his leadership weakens, weakens, weakens. Then in the Korach thing, it gets as, you know, he's pushed against the wall as much as he can, and he, you know, it goes all the way to the other extreme. He asserts himself. So the Jews say, okay, challenging Moshe because he's too weak didn't get us anywhere. Let's go back to our old assumption that he's a superpower. But whatever we can do, let's deny that he has the truth. But once you have both extremes, you have the Korach incident, which prevents you from believing that he's a mere man. And then you have this incident where he stands against God, right? And God lets him do it. God lets him stop the angel of death. And God gives him a quiet miracle that can't be misconstrued as a vindictive guy trying to assert his power. They're led to the only conclusion they can, that Moshe is a balanced, legitimate representative of God who does everything in his power to save the Jews, but isn't always successful. But once you've hit that happy medium, so maybe you'll be at peace with Moshe, but then the reality of the next 40 years sets in, is that God, that it's God calling the shots, and God said there's no way out of this. And Moshe, in all his ability to defend us, he managed to save us temporarily, but he didn't manage to undo this. He tries. Look, he just saved us from this magefa, from this, but he can't save us from the next 38 years. We're going to die. We're not going in. And so the story sort of tragically ends, and their last words are, "Heng avadnu avadnu kulanu avadnu." That's it, right? If Moshe's true, if Moshe's telling the truth, then God's calling the shots, and God said it, and Moshe can't defend us, and we're done. And then they panic, right? And it's specifically that moment of calm, right? There's a different level of panic, right? There's frenzied panic, which is what we had before. Korach and, you know, Meraglim. But then there's calculated panic, right? It's not, we're not, I get the truth. All the facts are here. I'm no longer building it up. It's not worse than I think it is. It's exactly what I think it is, right? When you have all the details on the table and you say, no, I'm not over-exaggerating. This is actually the prognosis of, you know, this is God's decree. This is it, you know. And you have all the details without exaggeration. That's like the most, it's not a frenzied panic. It's a calculated panic. It's a recognition that the situation is dire. And that's it. And that's where we get, that's the last we hear of the Jewish people, of this generation. And the next time we pick up, it's a new generation, it's their children. We've moved on. And that's sort of the very tragic and very powerful sort of end to the first generation. This is the end. The only thing I'll just add here is that you can't fully blame the Jewish people for their unclarity as to who Moshe is and what he can do. Because the truth is, it is totally unclear. I gave you a link here. But if you want to read about it, it's like 85 pages worth of material. But one of the most, it's not just them, the Mefarshim throughout the ages have not been able to put their finger on the question of to what extent does Moshe or any Navi have independence? Because, like in this story, it's not really clear, did God actually tell him to stop the plague or not? On the one hand, you'd say, how can he stop the angel of death if he wasn't sent by God? On the other hand, can he really have been explicitly sent by God? Why would God send the angel of death and send Moshe to stop him at the same time? But it's true throughout the Torah. When he breaks the luchot, the Mefarshim divide, did God tell him to break the luchot or not? It's not clear in context. Right? It could be he did, it could be he didn't. When he says, God, whoever is for God, come and let's kill the sinners. Did God tell him to do that? Or was he intuiting that that's what God wanted? And the Mefarshim on every one of those have a machloket. Every one. And it's not just Moshe. Eliyahu. When Eliyahu says there'll be no rain for the next 3 years, have the Midrashim say Eliyahu decided and forced God's hand. Right? Some of the Mefarshim say can't be. God would never let him force his hand. When he ends the rain, right? So then it clearly is God, because God says, end the rain. But when Elisha performs the miracles, again, we don't know. Is it from God? Not. When Yeshua stops the sun, the Mefarshim don't know. Did Yeshua stop the sun because God told him to stop the sun, or he decided it of his own and God listened to him? So the truth is, it's not just that it's hard to put your finger on it in the Chumash. The truth is that it's not even quite clear how much power Moshe has. He is not acting totally independently, but it's also not clear that he's not acting independently at all. He might actually be, which, to be fair to the Jews, makes it all the more ambiguous. He is a legitimate representative of God's will. That doesn't mean that everything he does was an explicit instruction from God. Sometimes it just means he intuits God's will well. But if you want to understand why the Jews are so confused about who Moshe is and what he can do, it's because, honestly, you look through the Torah, a fair reading of Torah and Nevi'im doesn't give you a clear answer to that question. And it's really not clear. Are Nevi'im always acting exactly the way God said, or are they just intuiting it? It makes it worse that sometimes we know they get it wrong. Right? The classic example is Natan HaNavi, where David says to Natan, I want to build the Beit HaMikdash. Natan says, great. That's a great idea. Go build a Beit HaMikdash. Natan goes home, he goes to sleep, and in the middle of the night, he has a dream, and Hashem says, no, not a good idea. Tell David it's not time to build a Beit HaMikdash, it's going to be his son. So Natan has to go and change his mind. So the Mefarshim struggle. Does that prove that Nevi'im often are working without explicit sanction from God, and usually they're right, and God has to clarify? Right? Or is this proof that what does that story tell us? It tells you that at least sometimes Nevi'im aren't speaking in God's name, but is that only when they're acting in their role as advisor to the king, but not as prophet? Or is it true of prophets too? That you can actually have someone say, Ko Amar Hashem, and it'll be wrong. Right? Is that possible?
But right? Navi doesn't have a nevuah non-stop, right? So sometimes they can just speak out of...
Correct, and that's why some of the Mefarshim divide between Moshe and everybody else. Right? Because by most Nevi'im, it's pretty easy to say, yeah, maybe sometimes they act without Nevuah, because Nevuah wasn't constant. Moshe's Nevuah was much more constant, so some of Hashem will divide. Moshe is always direct, and everybody else is sometimes direct, sometimes indirect. But the very fact that, hundreds and thousands of years of Mefarshim, reading the same psukim over and over, have argued about whether every time Moshe seems to do something without explicit sanction, and Yoshua and Elisha and Eliyahu and Shmuel, and take your pick of the Navi, that the fact that the Mefarshim can't figure out when God is telling them to do it, when they're intuiting God's will, that's part of why it's so complex to put your finger on who Moshe is. The answer clearly isn't that he's a mere human, and the answer isn't that he's a demigod acting without God at all. But because the answer isn't clear, is he acting with the explicit divine command, or just he's a legitimate person who can intuit God's will, or sometimes it's this and sometimes it's that, he really doesn't occupy a middle space. That's why it's hard to put your finger on it. You can empathize with the Jews, with the Jews' chaos. But that sort of brings us to the end of this first generation, right? And this is sort of a fitting end to the insanity that we've seen in Moshe's leadership. Because, as I said, what you had was, you know, sort of a trajectory down of his leadership unraveling, and they're challenging him more and more and more. And then you have the Korach one, where it hits rock bottom, and Moshe reasserts himself in such a glorious way that the Jews move to their old critique, which is, okay, you're not weak, you're too strong, and you're calling the shots. And then it ends with God setting the record straight, that it's not here, it's not there, it's that terrifying middle space, that he really does intuit my will, and therefore when he tells you something harsh, it's really me. It's really me speaking through him, which the Jews seem to resign themselves to, which maybe is to their credit, right? The last thing we hear from them is panic, but it's also resignation to that hard space that Moshe occupies with all its implications. So that brings us to the end of that saga. And like I said, once you start Chukas, this is a different Jewish people, right? We, in Parshiot, it's only a few psukim apart, but we're in the 40th year by that point. So we meet a new generation.